Good evening, everybody. Welcome to my session. I'm in the back of the room, so you're not distracted by this nerd walking around there. And you can pay all your attention to my slides. And I can see if you're taking pictures. I have a good overview here. And I can walk around. I'm actually surprised by the amount of people that are here at this moment. I mean, Friday afternoon. Why are you here? You have been drunk yesterday, right? Are you from Italy?
No, Greece.
Oh, Greece. Anybody from Italy here? Have you been drunk?
Yes.
Yes. People from Germany? I mean, you made it to the semi-final, right? I mean, I'm from Holland. It's like the Eurovision Song Contest. Netherlands, 0 points. Actually, we got more points at the Eurovision Song Festival, which is bad. Welcome to my session. I'm going to talk about load balancing Microsoft Exchange Server 2010. That's me. My name is Jaap Veselius. I'm a consultant here in the Netherlands. I work for a company called Innovatief, and we have two divisions, one system center division, and a couple of my colleagues are speaking here as well. And we have a unified communication division, where I am the managing consultant. I've been working for Microsoft for a couple of years. Before that, I was a consultant as well. And I've been working with Exchange since Exchange 5.0, so quite some time. And Exchange always has been some, how do you call it, red wire in my career. I do consulting work a couple of times per year. I do some training. I'm a frequent blogger. I write articles. I've been writing for msexchange.org, for simpletalk.com, my own blog, of course. Jaap Veselius, you can find me on Twitter as well. Just Google or Bing on Jaap Veselius and you'll be amazed by the amount of hits you get. And as long as you see that picture, it's me. The agenda for today. Some introduction on load balancing. And then some load balancing essentials. We're going to switch to Exchange 2010. And what does it mean for load balancing? Then we're going to do some hardware load balancers, load balancing resources, and I have a demo as well. I've been doing this session in Orlando 2 weeks ago. This session is online. Anybody has seen it? Nobody. Oh, it's actually, this is good. So I can make the same joke. So that's fine. I have three cards here. It's from Kemp. Number one, load balancing in price performance. I ask a question, you give the right answer, I'm satisfied, you get this license. You can download the software, install the license, and it will run until the end of days. It's a free, it's a normal production license. I also have three USB sticks. Same idea. I ask questions, you give the right answer, you get the USB stick. This one contains the software. It has a 30-day trial, but when you contact me or the camp guys, they are sitting here in front, you can get a license, no problem. Now, if you have questions, please keep them until the end of the session. Come up front here, we can have a discussion, we have plenty of time. I'm about to finish at 2:15, so we have some time left there, and take 30 minutes before Ilse will start, so it should be no problem. Why do you want a load balancer? The load balancer is for scalability. So if you have a lot of users, you can host them on one Exchange 2010 server. We're talking about protocols here. So we're talking about the client access server. You can host them on one server, but it's limited to X amount of people. You can add multiple servers, and the load balancer will spread the load across all Exchange servers. It's also about redundancy. I mean, after all, it's a physical device. It can fail. It can burn down. Windows can crash. exchange can stall, whatever can happen. You have to be prepared. One server can stop and the other ones will take over. If you have configured it correctly, nobody will notice. Also, when you want to patch your machines, you can take them out of the load balancing array, patch your machine, reboot it, continue with the next one. Nobody will know. Hey, the history of load balancing. Microsoft has a service. It's built into Windows. Windows load balancing services first appeared in NT4. It's a service running on the actual Windows machine. It was renamed to NLB, Network Load Balancing, in Windows 2000. It's still available in 2008 R2, and it will be available again in Windows 2012. But in the early days, there was no Exchange load balancing. We had an Exchange server, only one, maybe two. And clients were distributed because they were connecting directly to the database. They were distributed across both servers, if you have two. There were only static websites. And spreading load for static websites is relatively easy. But Exchange grew and became bigger and bigger and more users and became dynamic and stuff. So there are some issues. You can Exchange run, or you can run NLB in unicast. You can run it in multicast mode. It runs fine, but there are some drawbacks. For example, when you use your NLB in unicast mode, there is a risk of switch or port flooding because your NLB is faking the MAC address. And if you have multiple servers, you have the same MAC address on multiple servers. Switches typically don't like it. They can get confused. And there's a risk of port flooding. There are scalability issues with more than 8 nodes. Very important. NLB is not service aware. So you can implement NLB on a CAS array, on an array of CAS servers. It will run fine. It will monitor the individual servers if they are online. But it does not monitor the servers running on there. So if you offer OAuth, it does not check on port 80 or port 443. If you're running POP3, it does not check on port 110. So the web service can die, the server can be up and running, and NLB doesn't notice. You create a connection to the NLB, the service is dead, and your client seems to hang. There's only source IP available for persistence. I have 2 slides on persistence later on. Also important, it cannot be combined with a database availability group, a DAG. What you see lately is that Microsoft is going to recommend creating multi-role servers. One server, client access, hub transport, and mailbox server on it. If you have a database availability group, under the hood, it's using cluster service, failover clustering. And these failover clustering bits cannot be combined with the NLB bits on the same machine. Now, on TechEd 2010, 2 years ago, in Berlin, there was a session presented by Ross Smith. And he, out of the blue, said, Microsoft is now recommending hardware load balancers for Exchange. And most people understand that or hear that, interpret that as Microsoft no longer supports NLB. That's not the case. Microsoft is fully supporting NLB. And there are quite some customers running happily on NLB. But if you can live with the drawbacks, then you're absolutely fine. That's no problem. So Microsoft is recommending hardware load balancers. And they are also referred to as application delivery controller. And it's a separate node in the network, independent of Windows. So it's a device, and it can be a physical device, but it can also be a virtual machine running on VMware on Hyper-V, which actually does the load balancing. And there is some smart intelligence or logic in there as well. so it can do some smart load distribution. It is service aware, so it checks if the web service is available. It checks if the SMTP service is available, or the POP3 service is available. It can check on the individual virtual directories. So you can create a load balancing solution for ActiveSync, and it will check the ActiveSync virtual directory. You can do the same for Outlook WebApp, and it will check the OAuth virtual directory. You have multiple persistence options. Now we're getting to the more expensive ones. There are compression options. You can do SSL offloading, caching of OAuth attachments, packet shaping, packet stream modifications. More and more options are available in these hardware load balancers. The key takeaways of this introduction: use load balancing for scalability and recovery. Microsoft recommends to use a hardware load balancer. Windows NLB is still supported, has some drawbacks. If you can live with it, you're fine. Load balancer essentials. There are a couple of terms you have to be aware of. The setup of the hardware load balancer, for example, can be a one-arm configuration or a two-arm configuration. The routing of the network packets through the load balancer. Are you going to use SourceNet? Are you going to use direct server return? Or are you going to use a load balancer default gateway solution? Yes. Persistence is very important in Exchange 2010. You can implement persistence based on HTTP header. So the load balancer will check the HTTP header and decide which client access server to connect to and keep the connection to this specific server. There are cookie solutions. There are source IP solutions. And there are SSL session ID solutions for persistence. There's also the distribution of the connections. So the client connects to the hardware load balancer, and the hardware load balancer distributes the connections between the cache servers. It can be based on round robin, and it can be based on leased connections. And the leased connections are several variants available for this. The load balancer virtual service is an instance running on the load balancer. And this instance has its own fully qualified domain name. And it has its own IP address and port number. And it's also referred to as virtual IP or VIP. The term VIP in a load balancer solution is widely used. It's most likely, okay, I have this IP address, FQDN and port number. A VIP for OAuth, for example, or for Outlook Anywhere. Each service has its own settings for persistence, for distribution, for timeout, for SSL offloading, and you can create multiple VIPs, multiple virtual services, each with their own settings. You have to be aware that each vendor, there are several vendors, and each uses its own naming conventions. So vendor A is talking about the virtual server, vendor B is talking about the VIP, whatever. You always have to check with your vendor. Some load balancing essentials. We have a network over there, and this network can be the internet, it can be the normal LAN or the WAN, whatever your company network infrastructure looks like. And all clients connect to this virtual IP, 10.10.0.11 in this case. It accepts the connection, and it will distribute the connection to one of the servers, Exchange 1, 2, or 3. 10.10.0.1, 2, or 3. And in this example, it's a multi-role with a DAC. Now here comes the first question. Is this a single arm or a two arm configuration? I don't have that many cards. Women and children first. Women, yeah. Let's see, somebody was waving here.
Single arm.
Why?
Everything's in the same subnet.
That's good. You use Exchange 2010?
Yeah.
You use a load balancer?
Getting there.
What kind of?
We're using NLB with thinking about moving to hardware.
Oh, yeah. That's for you. Five to go. Now, in Orlando, I forgot the last one. So everybody was leaving. I had to come up with another question about, of course, the football match. But I'll try to do the other five during the session as well. Yes, this is a single arm configuration. All clients are in the same subnet. It has one network card. It can cause some routing issues. You have to be aware of this. So you have to come up with a solution. It can be SourceNet, it can be the default gateway solution, or it can be the direct server return. We have a one-arm configuration. So we have a network, 10.10.0.0, we have the client over here, and we have two exchange servers. And the client is going to connect to the virtual IP of the load balancer. And the load balancer, in turn, is going to connect to Exchange Server 2. This is a SourceNet solution. So the IP address changes. The Exchange Server sees an incoming request, but it comes from the IP address of the load balancer. It's going to return to this IP address, and the load balancer, in turn, connects to the client. Everything is fine. Now let me go to this one. I'm going to do this side of the room first. What's the drawback here? A more difficult question. Ah.
Monitoring the sessions from the exchange server will show only the Kemp's IP address, the virtual server IP address.
That's right. You already have a hardware load balancer? Okay. You were waving as well.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. You cannot see the IP address of the client.
Ah, that's way too easy. You have a hardware load balancer?
Yeah.
Is there anybody who doesn't have a hardware load balancer? You don't? Here, catch. Oh, sorry. Sorry. I'll get back to you. Now we go to the direct server return. This one is more difficult, more complex. The same client is going to connect to the virtual IP, and it's going to connect to the exchange server. Direct server return means the server is going to connect to answer directly to the client. And the client is getting confused because it's sending a request to IP address 11, but the answer is coming from .2. One advantage here is that there is no return traffic through the load balancer, but it's answering directly to the client. You have to do some configuration on the exchange server to get this up and running, to make the client aware that the return address is actually okay. Because the client does not expect the IP address of the cache server. There's no net, it's routing. You have to create a loopback adapter on the client access server, configured with the virtual IP of the load balancer. And layer 7 persistence is not supported because the exchange server is communicating directly with the client. The load balancer cannot do anything smart with the connection. It's more complex than using SourceNet, therefore the recommendation is to use SourceNet. A two-armed configuration means that the load balancer is actually connected using two network interfaces. One VIP is connected to subnet 1. The other one is connected to subnet 2. And subnet 2 is the lower part. It's the server VLAN. And the clients are connected to the client VLAN, whatever. The client is located over there on the 172 network, and it's going to connect to the external IP address of the load balancer. The load balancer connects to Exchange Server 2. It's going to respond to Exchange Server 2, and the load balancer in turn is going to respond to the client. Here as well, we see the same issue. What's locked on the Exchange Server is actually the IP address of the load balancer. So you have to be aware of the routing possibilities or the routing issues that can happen in a load balancer configuration. Persistence. Persistence is the way clients connect to a client access server, and how the connection is maintained. The continuance of an effect after its cause is removed. For example, I am connected to a specific cache server and something happens. For example, my wireless connection here is flaky. I want to be connected to this particular server. Or when I have an open connection, but I'm grabbing some coffee, whatever, I'm not doing anything, I want to keep this connection open. I want to stay connected to this particular client access server, especially when we're talking about stateful connections. OWA, for example. You want a connection to an OWA server. You are creating a new message. The actual rendering is taking place on the client access server, and you don't want to be reconnected to, at a certain moment, to another client access server. Because what's happening there is unaware there. So you have to be careful about that. Persistence. Persistence is also referred to as stickiness or affinity. And it's all about stateful connections. And this stateful connection, that's the key when it comes to persistence. OWA, for example, is stateful. But POP3 or AutoDiscover are not stateful connections. And I always refer to them as a point-and-shoot protocol. You create a connection, you get your information, the connection is closed. I don't care whether it be server 1, 2, or server 6. It's a one-off connection. Persistence is something different than load distribution. Load distribution is the way the connections are spread. This is how the connection is maintained. There are a couple of ways to maintain the session or the persistence. SSL session ID, for example. When a client sets up a connection with the client access server using SSL, the client is negotiating with the server on a session ID. And this session ID is in the initial header of the packages. And the load balancer can read the session ID, and it knows, okay, this session ID is connected to server 1. And this session ID is connected to server 2. And it will check the session ID of all incoming traffic and knows how to keep all connections. It can be based on cookies. We have server-side cookies, exchange cookies. OWA will create cookies. ECP will create cookies. We can use that. We can also have the load balancer create cookies. And these are placed inside the header, and the load balancer will check for this cookie and decide, okay, server 1, server 2, server 3. There is hash persistence, sometimes referred to as super HTTPS. And here you see multiple vendors, multiple solutions. The same ID, the same background, but different implementations. It can combine various parts of the header and hash them in some way, and it will do some magic for keeping the connections. There's also source IP, and in source IP, the only thing the load balancer does is checking What's the originating IP address? This IP address is connected to that server. And that IP address is connected to that server. Cookie and hash need SSL offload. Why does it need an SSL offload? You have to inspect the HTTP headers for cookie and hash. If you're using an SSL connection from the client through the load balancer to the client access server, there's no way you can inspect the header information because it's encrypted. So if you want to use these options, you have to implement SSL offloading. And SSL offloading means, therefore, smarter persistence options. And at this point, SSL is terminated at the load balancer. And it offloads intensive processor utilization from the client access server. Now, this is a bit of a marketing piece. And this was true a couple of years ago. Right now, at this moment, hardware processor is so strong, this is only a matter of a few percent. So that's no longer really true. You want to do it for smart persistence options. From the load balancer to the exchange server can be SSL. So you can re-encrypt the traffic to the client access server. You can also use port 80. No offloading means there's only source IP persistence or SSL session ID persistence. There's an excellent wiki article, How to Configure SSL Offloading in Exchange 2010. It's pretty easy. It's a registry key. It's located in the local machine, current control set services, MS Exchange OWA. And you have to create a dword SSL offloading named SSL offloaded, and it has the value 1. Then you go to IIS Manager, and you have to check all virtual directories. There's an option, SSL setting. You have to select it, and deselect require SSL. You go to Outlook. For Outlook Anywhere, you go to the Exchange Management Console, select Outlook Anywhere on the Client Access Server object, and uncheck the option. The registry key is for SP1 and SP2. Exchange 2010 RTM uses the web.config method. But SP1 is a completely different product than RTM, so don't alter web.config if you're using SP1 or SP2. Altering web.config in the SP1 or SP2, that's the safest way to disaster. If you have multiple servers, you can use a couple of PowerShell commands to enable SSL offloading. Set Outlook Anywhere, identity, new item property, you can set the registry key. You can also, of course, import a registry file and then use the set web configuration property on all virtual directories. These are only two shown here, otherwise there are five or six. Then you do an IIS reset and you're basically done. This is the way you enable SSL offloading on the client access server. You also have to be aware of your network infrastructure, and not only your own network infrastructure, but also where your clients come from. I have a load balancer, and I have three client access servers. And there is some NAT device, a TMG server or whatever, but it can also be some gateway of a provider. And we have multiple clients. We have an internal client. It's setting up a connection to the load balancer, and the load balancer decides we're going to connect to CAS1. And another client logs on to the load balancer. It's redirected to CAS2. Then we have an external client. It can be an Outlook Anywhere client, or it can be an ActiveScene client, whatever. It's going to connect to the gateway and then to the load balancer. But the trick here is that the load balancer only sees 10.15.8.1. and it's going to connect to CAS number 3. Another external client somewhere is going to connect through the same gateway. It's going to connect to the load balancer, and the load balancer again sees this IP address, and it's going to connect. Now imagine you have a mobile or a broadband provider. Mobile providers most often have a limited set of external IP addresses. So you can have 1,000 mobile clients using only 5 IP addresses, for example. And these are all connected to CAS 3. And therefore CAS number 3 is overloaded in this situation. You have a load balancer, you have multiple servers, you're fine, you think, and you will see that this particular server has a higher processor or a higher utilization than the other servers, or in the end it can be overloaded. And the solution here to use some cookie-based or HTTP, some smart solution. The key takeaway here is the transparency of your solution is key in the entire setup. Implement a one-arm or a two-arm configuration. Routing in your routing in your exchange environment, your packets, is extremely important, and you have to be aware of the persistence of your solution. Now, what does it mean for exchange? We have a couple of exchange servers, multi-role in this case. And we have a couple of edge servers for SMTP, load balances. We have Outlook clients, we have external clients, Outlook Anywhere, ActiveSync, Outlook Web App. Maybe we have some application servers, there's a multifunctional device, copiers, printers and stuff, all connected to the same network. The clients connect to the load balancers and connect to the client access servers. External SMTP traffic enters the edge servers. And the edge servers use the edge subscription to connect to the hub servers, but the edge subscription itself takes care of the load balancing. So it load balances all SMTP packages across all hub transport servers. And the other way, it's going to load balance the outbound SMTP traffic across multiple edge servers. Now, why do you want to use SMTP on your load balancers? For example, if you have application servers relaying, your application servers will send SMTP messages to the load balancer, and the load balancer will distribute across all servers. There's only one thing here. This is when you use an edge configuration. What happens if you use forefront online protection for exchange? Another one. I won't throw it this time. What's the difference when I use FOPI? The CAS array is client access. FOPI is SMTP. Sorry?
You'll be routing out to the external FOPI service.
Yes, and inbound? Yes. So you have forefront online protect, but you can also have some other online SMTP or antivirus, anti-spam solution. It will have one source IP address, and you can enter it directly to the load balancer, and the load balancer in turn will take care of the SMTP load balancing. There you go. We have several client protocols. So we're talking again about the client access server. HTTPS, for example. Outlook Web App. Or the Exchange Control Panel is running on HTTPS. But also, Outlook Anywhere is using HTTPS to connect to the client access server. We have MAPI. Outlook clients on the internal network use MAPI to connect to the client access server. We have POP3, we have IMAP4, and we have SMTP. The only difference here is public folder. And public folder access is not handled by the client access server. if you have an Outlook client that wants to connect to a public folder database, it will connect to the RPC client access server running on the mailbox server where the public folder is actually located. So it will connect not through the client access server but to the mailbox server. You have to be aware of when implementing a load balancer. When it comes to persistence, there are a few services that have a persistence requirement. For RPC client access, this is the way MAPI clients, Outlook clients, connect to the client access server. And this is also at the same time the major difference between Exchange 2010 and Exchange 2007. In 2007, the clients connect directly to the mailbox server, and here they connect to the client access server. The RPC client access server is responsible for this. Outlook Web App and Exchange Control Panel and the Exchange Web Services all require persistence. So you set up a connection to the client access server, and you have to, or the load balancer needs to maintain the connection to the same client access server. Recommended for persistence, Outlook Anywhere, Exchange Active Sync, Address Book Service, and Remote PowerShell. It's recommended from a performance point of view. If you don't have persistence for Outlook Anywhere and you switch to another server, there is the possibility for a performance impact. Not required, these are more the point and shoot, as I referred to earlier, the offline address book, AutoDiscover, POP3, and IMAP4. You create a connection, you get your information, the connection is closed. I want to talk a bit about the client access server array, the CAS array. The CAS array is nothing more than a MAPI endpoint, an FQDN, in your Exchange environment. And it's set on the mailbox database using the RPC client access server property. You have to create a virtual service with this FQDN and VIP on the load balancer. And this can be something like outlook.contoso.com. And this is the FQDN you see in your Outlook profile. So this is your Outlook profile, and you see there your server, in this case is outlook-vesalius.local. This is the FQDN that the Outlook uses to connect to the server. I have a VIP connected, a service created on my load balancer, and it's going to distribute all MAPI requests across the client access server configured in my VIP. And the RPC client access uses MAPI, port 135, which is a static port, plus dynamic ports somewhere in the high range for RPC and address book. So the Outlook set up a connection on port 135, and it's going to negotiate two other ports for RPC and the address book. This works fine in a normal flat network, but as soon as you have a load balancer or a firewall or whatever, you want to use static ports. And Microsoft recommends to use static ports in a load balance scenario. And you can use the registry to control this behavior. MAPI is a stateful session. And important, source IP is the only persistent option available here. And here is another question. Why do we only have source IP available? This side of the room.
Because there is no SSL, it's MAPI.
The second part is true. There is no HTTPS. It's just RPC traffic. There you go. Use round-robin distribution for connecting the MAPI or distributing the MAPI request across multiple servers. You can implement least connection, but it can overboost the cache after a reboot. Now, overboot, there are some quotes around it. What I mean here is that when you use least connection, the load balancer is going to monitor the client access server for availability. How many connections are there? And at one point you reboot the server, it comes up, and the load balancer says, oh, zero connections. There you go, and it throws in 100 connections. But the server at that point is still working on its reboot. And it's extremely busy at that point. And it gets another 100 connection, and it's going to struggle to keep these all alive and work on it, and it can take some time. It can overboost the client access server at this point. Multiple vendors know this can happen and have built-in solution into their product to prevent an overboost situation right after a reboot. Again, there's an excellent wiki page, configuring static RPC ports on an Exchange 2010 client access server. You can find it here. There's a snag here. You have to create one for the RPC service, which is located in the local machine hive, Microsoft MS Exchange RPC. You have to create a D word. Name it TCP/IP and enter the port number. For the address book service, it's in a local machine, MS Exchange AB parameters, you have to create a string. Call it RPC TCP port and assign a number. I have highlighted these in red. One day, most likely the first day, you will use two D words. And the RPC will work fine and the address book service will not work. Be aware, do not use a D word, use a string here. And don't forget the public folders. The public folders do not connect to the client access server, but connect directly to the mailbox server. If you want to use the static port, do this on the mailbox server, specifically for the RPC client access server on the mailbox server. You can also use a registry file or the PowerShell for setting these static ports. When we use Outlook Anywhere, we have actually MAPI traffic, because Outlook uses MAPI to connect to the Exchange server. But the MAPI packages are encapsulated in HTTPS packages. And HTTPS is easy to route on the network, on the internet. Persistence is recommended for this, and use source IP for this. These are Microsoft recommendations. What you will see is that Microsoft recommendations are not always the same as the vendor recommendations. So F5 can use different recommendations than KEMP, which in turn can use different recommendations than Cisco, for example. And it's my personal best practice or advice recommendation to use the recommendations made by this specific vendor. In Outlook 2010, there's an additional cookie created, Outlook session cookie, that can be used for persistence as well. The Outlook Anywhere client ends, or the session ends, on the client access server, on the RPC proxy server running on the cache server. There the HTTPS trunk is ended and the MAPI traffic comes out of this big HTTPS pipe. It's not going back to the load balancer, but it's sent directly to the RPC proxy DLL on the client access server. So it does not use the MAPI VIP. If you are using only Outlook Anywhere, there's no need to arrange something for MAPI traffic. Outlook Anywhere will set up two connections, RPC in data and RPC out data, for inbound and outbound traffic between the client access server and the Outlook clients. And these connections are used for alignment within the servers. But there is a performance penalty. You also have to be aware of timeout issues, because you set up two connections, or Outlook is going to set up two connections, it's possible that one connection is going to timeout. Suppose RPC in data is timing out, you only have one connection left. It can happen, you will send an email and it will sit in the outbox. It will not send. And you have to restart Outlook actually to send the message. There was a session from Scott Snoll yesterday or the day before on his tips and tricks, who explained this more in detail and the solution for this. Another one I want to discuss a bit is OWA and ECP. OWA and ECP are stateful connections. The source IP can be used, especially when you have a large IP range, and you can SSL offload, or it can be disabled for ECP. You can also use some smart technology when you use SSL offloading and use the HTTPS solution. Exchange client access server has multiple virtual directories and server settings. So OWA has its virtual directory, ECP has a virtual directory, ActiveSync has a virtual directory, OAB has a virtual directory. These all have their settings. Also, the client access server object itself has specific settings. And you have this virtual IP address. The virtual IP is external and internal. And you have to set the auto-discover service internal URI to the NLB. So it will pick one of the multiple client access servers. The web services internal NLB bypass URL, for example, is set to the server FQDN. There are not many applications using this internal NLB bypass URL, but for example, Macintosh clients are using this to connect. This is just some cheat sheet you can print and use at the server, but most of the settings use the load balancer FQDN for both the internal as well as the external configuration and URL. If you have a non-internet facing Active Directory site containing client access server, all these settings should be set to null. The key takeaways here. Think about the workload and think about their requirements. Are you a service provider? I know a couple of service providers who offer quite a lot of POP3, for example. It's different than MAPI connections. It's different than Outlook Anywhere connections. Use static ports if you have MAPI clients. And depending on the vendor, use multiple virtual services, multiple VIPs. Check with your vendor. There are vendors who can create one VIP, and inside using this one VIP, they can monitor multiple virtual directories. So they will monitor for the /OWA, /Microsoft Server, ActiveSync, all in the same VIP. There are also vendors out there who recommend to use multiple VIPs for each service. The resources and vendors. There's a wiki page, Exchange Client Access Array and Load Balancing Resources. And it contains TechNet videos, articles, vendor documentations, sizing tools, whatever. It contains information about the Load Balancer Qualification Program. You can find it here. And the Load Balancer Qualification Program is not like some sort of certification program. It only says, okay, if you are using or offering load balancing solutions, this is how you qualify for this program. You need to use good hardware, you need to supply Exchange documentation, how to use the solution with Exchange, a quick start guide, all kinds of offerings like that. So information can be found here. And these are the actual vendors that are on this qualification program. I have seen Kemp, I have seen F5 here on Microsoft TechEd. There are a few more. I have working with Redware, for example, A10 Networks, with Kemp, of course, F5. But there are also a couple of more available. These are the hardware solutions. But the load balancer is nothing more than just a piece of intelligent software running on a server. So there are a couple of vendors who offer the same software as a virtual machine, available for Hyper-V or for VMware. You can download it, install it as a virtual machine, start it, and it will do exactly the same trick. There is one major difference between a hardware load balancer and the same solution as a virtual machine. What's the difference? The next question is this side.
Virtual machine will be restricted by the resources available.
Yeah, but the same is true for a hardware device. If you have a small hardware device, it's restricted to the resources. That was not the answer I was looking for. Yes, that was the answer I want to know. The hardware solution has a dedicated chip on it for SSL offloading, and it will take care of all the SSL transactions. And the chipset on the device will take care of all the SSL transactions, and this will perform fast, extremely fast. And if you have a virtual machine, of course, the virtual machine and therefore the host where the VM is running has to take care of that. Now, let's see here. I have my server here. I know it's not there, but my connection went black. So, let me... There it is. Oh. I have three Exchange servers here. Three client access server. Exchange 1 and 2, these are a multi-role configuration, and I have a third server which only has the client access server role on it. And I have a hardware load balancer. We have to talk about this. I gave away all my licenses. I only have this one left. But I have this Kemp Loadmaster available here. I'm not biased. I happen to have a few of these. But at the same time, I'm working with customers with F5, A10 networks, Barracuda, or Cisco solutions. So the first thing I have to do here is enable SSL offloading. Now, the offloading here is pretty easy. I can go to the properties of this machine, Outlook anywhere, and it's just a matter of allow SSL offloading. I can go to the registry, navigate through the correct hive to this key here and add the properties. But easier is to use a small PowerShell script. Is it readable? Can you read it from the back? Yeah, okay. It's just pretty easy. It's always handy to have this around. It disables it enables SSL offloading. It imports the registry key. It imports the web administration module, and it sets the virtual directories. You can do this manually if you only have two servers. If you have six servers, then most likely you will make some error somewhere. A couple of weeks ago, I also created a small blog on this, including the script how to do this. Turn it off, and that's it. Now it's done. So this is not that difficult. It's going to do an IIS reset. Okay, that's fine. Here we have the load balancer. And here on the left hand, we have this menu. We can browse to the virtual services. It's all empty at this moment. There are no statistics, no real servers. The real servers are the actual client access servers. I can create rules, do some checking content rules, certificates, and some system configuration. I have two Ethernet cards here, ETH0 and ETH1, which you can use for one arm or two arm configuration. It can happen that you have a configuration with more Ethernet ports, and then in that case the other ports are used for creating high available solutions. Because when you have one load balancer, works fine. The load balancer is a single point of failure. So if you have multiple or a second load balancer and create a cluster, it will use the additional ports to send information and you create a master-slave solution. And there are some more options available here. I can create a virtual address, for example, for OWA, Outlook Web App. Say I want. .251 on port 443. OWA, server 1 in this case. I'm not going to create a template, and I says, okay, create this service. Now I have to fill in all the options, and you have to be very careful in it. You can say, okay, force layer 7, use additional ports. What persistence options do I have? In this case, source IP, super HTTP, hash, whatever. I'm going to use source IP here. What's the timeout value? I say it, set it to an hour. Round robin. Wait round robin, least connections, or wait least connections. These are some minor variants. What can happen, for example, if you have multiple servers, and one server has more powerful hardware and therefore is capable of using or handling more connections. You can give it a higher priority and will handle more connections. But I say, okay, oh, wrong mouse. Round robin. Give it, nah. And here, use address for server NAT. The problem here is that you have to be very careful when setting all these options. I spent an hour with CAMP support on the telephone only finding out that we forgot to check this box. SSL properties, I want to enable this. Okay. And I have to add a new certificate. Now this is a bit of a crappy interface because I say, okay, I give this a name, say exchange, say, okay, import the certificate, and now I can import the actual certificate backup. Pass one word. So, ooh. It's successful, okay. I add the certificate to the new virtual service, and we're done on this part. The service at this point is still down because we created the virtual service, we entered the or a few of the properties, but we didn't add a virtual or a client access server at this point. Here we have some more properties. We leave, let's see, default gateway, no. We go to the real server, HTTP, we're going to connect using port 80, and we're going to check on the slash. OWA URL. And I'm going to add this server. And now when we go here, you will see it is still down. Now I hear. Let's see. Checkport 80, set checkport. And the sub I, let's see. Oh, wacht eens even. Like this. No. This. See, it's going to add it on port 80, so this is fine. And now it's up. So now we have created this rule for OWA. It's going to check, and I have added one server. I'm going to delete it again. Okay, and I'm going to do manage templates. And I've installed these templates on the machine. These are just the basic templates, HTTPS, HTTPS offloaded, MAPI, and SMTP. And I can just say, okay, add a new one. I'm going to use the same IP address. Offload, and I'm going to. And right now it's going to use all the settings recommended by KEMP for this particular server. And this makes life much more easy when you want to create all the servers. I can go through the entire menu again. But I'm going to switch to the other one. And here I have created multiple virtual services. My lab environment crashed 3 weeks ago due to some power outages, so this is my production environment. And I have created multiple rules for OWA, ActiveSync, Outlook Anywhere, AutoDiscover, and the web services. And therefore you need multiple IP addresses, and you can monitor on all servers. I have two client access servers into production right now. And I can do all kinds of monitoring on this. I can check for the statistics, for example. It's not very busy at this moment. I can check on the servers, how many connections. It's extremely quiet the last hour. There are no connections at all. And I can monitor on the specific services. Now, when I want to patch a particular server, I can go to the real server and say, okay, I want to patch the first one, and I say disable, and it's going to gracefully end all connections. New connections will automatically be connected to the other one. I can install hotfixes, I can reboot the machine, nobody will notice. In the end, just say enable, do the trick on the other one, and you're absolutely fine. I did it last week, no one noticed at all. So that's pretty neat to use hardware load balancers. So, the summary of my presentation. Microsoft recommends to use a hardware load balancer. But NLB can still be used. We cannot talk about Exchange 15. That's a pity, and everybody is not liking the fact we cannot say. But in 1 year, I can do a slightly different session. So this is quite important for now, for Exchange 2010, and in the future. Think about the Exchange workload. Important aspects, transparency, routing, persistence, and always check with your vendors. What's the Microsoft recommendation? What's the vendor recommendation? And I have some good and some bad. I have only one left. This guy is from KEMP. Think about a question. No, you're not getting one.
What's the lowest price load balancer in the market?
It's a marketing question. He's a certified master. I happen to know him. He's not getting one. Okay, I'll take his the lowest price for camp. Anyone? Anyone? No. That's too low. An HA proxy is free, but that's the wrong answer. Oh, now I have an. Oh, I'm sorry. It's a female over there. Oh, yeah. He's an MVP. He's not allowed to have one too.
It's free because you can use Windows Network Load Balancing and you're already paying for Windows.
That's the answer he gave. Okay, now then you again.
Cheapest hardware. Load Balancer is from Kemp and I believe it's $1,800.
It's a little bit more, but okay. I'll accept that one. The good news! It's holiday season. So, we're out here in an hour or 1.5 hours and then we're off. It's July and that's it. The bad news is, my session is over. Ah! Thank you for coming. Please do not forget to fill out the evaluation forms. I don't know how many people there are here, quite a lot. And it's a bit frustrating when next week they come to me, you only had 10 evaluations. So please fill out the evaluation forms. Thanks for coming. The presentation will be online, so check back if you want to. Send me an email, whatever. Or come with questions up here.